JB Manje Savitri, everyone. I'm Thanmori Soundarajan, and this is Cast in the United States with First Post. Today's episode is an exploration of Savarna fragility. We often don't get to talk openly about what experiences of Savarna fragility are, and our guest today, Priya, is here to help us talk openly about what it is and how to navigate it, particularly since Savarna fragility is one of the most potent roadblocks to annihilating caste. We really welcome this conversation and thank Priya for sharing her experiences. Jai Bhim, Priya.
Jai Bhim, and thank you very much for having me.
So Priya, I'm really curious, what was that moment when you started challenging caste?
I don't think that there was one moment. I think there were many bits and pieces that didn't make sense. And if I could go back and remember my earliest experiences, it was mostly questioning things within the family, at, you know, growing up as a child. And when I was probably like 8-9 years old, I remember my grandmother and my mother telling me stories from the Ramayana and Mahabharata and all these things. And I remember questioning many of things, saying, oh, you know, this was unfair. They couldn't, you know, do this. Why did they not have a duel with Karna just because he was the son of a charioteer? Why did they do this to Draupadi? How could they have just gambled her away as a piece of property? You know, I mean, just open-ended questions I used to ask as a child at home. You know, I was kind of silenced in this very loving manner, saying, oh, you're so cute. Oh, you ask too many questions. And I felt bad for my grandmother because sometimes she would just say, I don't have the answers to your questions. I mean, there were a lot of these little things that I would be taught, saying this is kind of the norm in a very unsaid manner. And then as I was growing up, I have a lot of cousin brothers that I grew up with. And slowly as I transitioned into the teens, I could really spot the differences between, you know, the expectations of me and the expectations of them. And I would keep bringing that up. And I remember there was this one festival that we have called Kanu in Tamilian Brahmin families, where the day after, the women of the house pray to the ancestors and pray for the well-being of their brothers. And I threw up a big fight saying that, you know, I wanted all my brothers to do it for me. And that was when I would do it for them, and that it was not fair. I threw a tantrum at the time. And that was another experience that kind of stayed with me for a very long time. The violent part of it, I remember, was when my grandmother died. Her sisters, on the day of the funeral, her sisters had gone into the room to help prepare her body, you know, to be taken away for cremation. I was 13 years old and I was kind of milling around from room to room and asking questions. And so I asked them, saying, so what are you going to do? How are you going to, you know, prepare this? And what I heard then, even to this day, was really chilling. So they said that because she died as a Sumangali is, you know, she died before my grandfather. So, you know, she wasn't widowed when she passed away. So she would be prepared like a bride and she would be sent, you know, for cremation. Whereas a woman who died as a widow would be really treated like a piece of nothing at all when she was sent away for cremation. And I just found that a very, very violent thought. And I remember these yearly, you know, Sumangali pujas that they used to do in the family, where they would remember all the women who passed away who hadn't been widowed, and they would leave out all the widows. And some of, you know, my dearest grand aunts had all passed away as widows, and I would find it, you know, it's like, oh, you know, there were these wonderful people and you are not taking the time to, you know, celebrate them. But I'd never really looked at them through a caste angle. It was much later when I started putting the pieces together that I actually started reading Baba Saheb, that, you know, he gave, you know, like a scientific basis connecting the dots, saying that this is the intent and this is the design. And because of this design, you will see these behaviors, and this is how, you know, it kind of perpetuates itself. So I never really had a systemic understanding of caste for a very, very long time, even though I could spot it in multiple places.
I think it's so poignant that so many people come into their understanding of caste through an understanding of gender, and that many dominant caste women really learn intersectionality from their first readings about Brahminical patriarchy through the words of Dr. Ambedkar. But I would like to now turn to Savarna Fragility again and really go deeper and ask you, you know, how have you addressed this in your family? Because that's really, you know, when we're talking about caste and gender, that is the heart of where we see it replicated.
I should probably talk about my experience of Savarna Fragility. I think it was when the first time it was pointed out that caste is an oppressive system was designed by Brahmins. My identity as, you know, a woman from a Brahmin family was kind of questioned, saying, you are part of the community that designed this oppressive system. I think it was a combination of guilt and fear. So one part of me knew that what they were saying was right. But at the same time, one part of me felt attacked. So it was a combination of the two that, you know, brought up those really angry, insecure feelings.
Yeah. And it's an important piece to know that, like, most people who start to challenge Savarna Fragility really start with their own self-examination, because it's really where your privilege rubs up against the facts that you've been prevented from learning because of the powerful filter bubble of caste networks. And when people finally get challenged on it, there's that place where, oh, I don't like this. This challenge, it challenges the sanitized origin story I've told about our greatness and our right to destiny and our intellectual superiority. And there is this decision point, right, where people really have to say, do I want to face the truth and the unknown that comes with this and learn things that maybe I don't necessarily feel comfortable with, but that discomfort could be a door into a wider reality? Or do I want to stay in and dig in into my Savarna privilege? And that's really the challenges that I see when you start to question and have critical thinking applied to these caste networks.
Absolutely.
And I'm wondering then, in terms of your own journey, like, how did you go from these, you know, flashpoints of awareness for yourself into more structurally challenging Savarna Fragility throughout the diaspora?
I think I will start with the resources that I had to kind of overcome that. And I think I looked to two kinds of people. One, someone, you know, who I deeply trusted with my insecurity. And second, who I knew was better informed, that I could feel comfortable questioning and probing and still not feel that, oh my God, you know, I'm just inquiring in this non-safe space. So I think it was just, more than anything, it wasn't that I needed anybody to kind of mollycoddle me, but just a space where I felt comfortable to explore the intellectual aspect of it, right? Where they wouldn't judge me, that, you know, really, you know, that I was blind and dumb in my privilege, and that, you know, anything that I would ask would just exposing my blind and dumb privilege. So I found that very helpful, because that was really critical for me to have made that journey to, in especially that transition period, which was probably just around a couple of topics. One was around Brahminical patriarchy. And I remember that I would keep questioning, saying, it's patriarchy. I mean, everybody's families, you know, have that. Why are you just singling out my community and calling it that? You know, that was when a friend pointed me to a paper to read on Brahminical patriarchy and said, no, there is something, there is a paper, it is, you know, social science, you go read it. And then when I read it, it started making a lot of sense. And because I had reached out to this person where I could feel safe and I knew that they were knowledgeable, I mean, that really helped me kind of make that transition. So there were like two or three topics that bothered me around, oh, you know, that I didn't want to come across as this terrible person by asking these questions. But I had to ask those questions in order to inform myself. So I think that helped me a lot.
And there is a deep, deep pain that all of us on all sides of the caste issue face, because, you know, caste is really one of the longest miseducation projects in world history. So many people don't even understand the basics of what the consequences of having such a predatory and violent system has had on hundreds of millions of people. And, you know, I've been doing a lot of thinking about the work of trauma expert Rezma Menachem, who wrote this book called My Grandmother's Hands. And when he's writing about the aspects of white supremacy, he talks about how much of it is really trauma-informed and that we cannot solve this just through cognitive arguments. We really have to have a 360 view of how we hold caste biases internal to our bodies, and also that it shapes our body's language of trauma and the ways that we engage with each other. I know for most Dalit Bahujans, the violence of caste has like really made us so that we really don't have the emotional resilience, nor is it our job to hold that empathetic space for dominant caste people to do that work. But I do think, and this is really the work that I've been really inspired by you and other colleagues of yours, is that, you know, I think this is really a time for powerful Savarna collaborators to anti-caste movements to hold that place of empathy and firmness, to be that pathway for dominant caste people who are shedding their privilege and need safe places to ask basic questions because of how deep the miseducation goes and how far back in their histories it's gone. And even something like Brahminical patriarchy, the thing that's so poignant about what you said is that you are seeing the disposability of the people that you love that are your elders. And you are also seeing how you're being trained for second class status as a woman. And, you know, as we know from Dr. Ambedkar, caste and gender are so deeply linked, and everyone's reproductive function is really seen through the lens of, can you promote the caste? And so when you lose your reproductive function, you lose your utility towards that system, which is why women are disposed of in this way. It's also why dominant caste women have one sort of layers of protection and caste oppressed women have, you know, no protections. It all comes down to reproductive privilege in this like terrible system. And as a child growing up in that, that's so painful. And imagine if you had an alternative network of, you know, aunties that could help you process that and also help you come on the other side of that.
Right. I still have trouble kind of processing some of that with my relationships of growing up. So I mentioned this earlier that because all of this was imbibed or all of this was communicated in the family growing up, you know, I mean, in the loving embraces of my mother and my grandmother, and I tend to be extremely critical of them. Of course, my grandmother has passed, but, you know, I have to figure out how to kind of, you know, come to terms with all of that without imposing some of that harshness back to my mother. I find myself extremely critical of her when we have these conversations, because a lot of those things just keep coming up because I feel that sense of betrayal. And I sometimes realize that, you know, these women have been betrayed too. It's you know, it's not like they had agency when, you know, they transmitted this from their elders to me.
And there is also this piece that part of it is that acknowledging your complicity with this violence isn't just that you have to, you know, face an unsavory origin story. You also have to think about what you have given up in order of your own humanity, in order to participate in it. And I think sometimes the truth of that is too great, because then you realize how much you yourself have also been cheated, like in the case of your mothers, as you were speaking about.
Right, right.
So what do you see like now in the diaspora? How do you see Savarna fragility operating? And what have been some of the ways that you've countered it?
I think in the diaspora, especially in the first generation, as in the immigrant group. So I am, you know, I mean, I was born and I grew up in India and then I moved to the US. So in my peer group, especially in the women, since we are talking a lot about patriarchy and fragility, it's the combination of two things that fights back. One is the discomfort of being questioned around your identity, which is the only thing you have, you know, having grown up in those spaces. and the second as an immigrant, where you want something that anchors you to your ancestors, to, you know, to the life that you have left and moved into. So I find that seems to be the bigger challenge, where, you know, you're questioning Hindu culture, you're questioning their festivals. And then if they step out of that, then they have nothing that anchors them to this, you know, to this new country. So I find that there are two things we're up against, especially in the immigrant community.
And so what advice then would you give to people who want to get over their own Savarna fragility?
I definitely think one is to, of course, trust the process and give space for that critical thought. And the second, of course, is for many of us Savarnas to provide that safe space where those conversations can happen. I think that is important, because people who are already dealing with that fragility are on that path of inquiry. But sometimes and it comes in different shades. And I have struggled where people have been really aggressive. And they push back, and I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, I mean, I'm a peer, you know, I'm someone that they are reaching out to. And if they're this aggressive with me, imagine, you know, how traumatic it must be for a Bahujan to be having these conversations with Savarna people.
Definitely. And do you think that this kind of experience of you understanding caste and gender and Savarna fragility, does it shape your experience as a mother?
Yes, and I think how it has applied itself, it's timely in the sense you asked me, because my older son is a freshman in college, and it was only just a little over a year ago that he was applying to universities. He would come back and, you know, talk to me about affirmative action. And I'm glad that I had made that journey where I was able to talk to my son about affirmative action. And he would say, oh, the women in my class, they are getting accepted into all the Ivy Leagues, but I had the same grades and I'm not getting accepted into any of the Ivy Leagues. And I was, you know, able to have that conversation with him about how women were historically excluded from education, and that these sorts of things are important because they continue to face discrimination in the workforce. And hence, it's important that you see more women being accepted than before. I'm glad that those things have kind of shaped conversations with my son around those things in kind of very practical ways. It isn't just, you know, it wasn't that we were theorizing about equity and racial justice, but that we were able to apply it in situations that we were coming from a place of privilege. And I would talk to him saying, you know, you can trace back college level education to at least 4 generations, if not 5. So you shouldn't be questioning somebody who hasn't been able to trace that sort of access to education. So I think that those really helped. And now with this reawakening of questions around racial justice and equity post the George Floyd murder, he has been more informed, and, you know, he is participating in many of those discussions with his classmates. And so I think that that definitely helped, and I felt that I was able to contribute to some of that.
And it feels like an important marker that, you know, it's really hard when you're in that place as a student waiting for your application. Like, you don't really care about addressing societal wrongs. You just really want to get your seat, right? But taking the lens of, like, what is the structural inequities that mean that not every student is actually participating in the same level of access is a very hard thing to talk about in the abstract until you can start to make it personal. And my argument always, whenever the issues of affirmative action or reservation comes up, is that it's not a really fair discussion, because people are assuming that there can only be a fixed number of seats. And I think that's a false notion set up by capitalism. And the reality is that education is a human right. We shouldn't be talking about why some schools are better than others. We should have all grade schools, and we need to have all curriculum be equivalent and the access and opportunities out of those schools be equivalent. And if we don't have enough admissions, then we need to invest more in schools than we do in like the military. you know, it feels like these false decisions are really being put on the backs of oppressed peoples, when actually we need to put our insight into why is society organized in a way where they're making people compete against each other, when we can actually be collaborating for greater social good.
Absolutely. And you're completely right about education, where it is only by creating this artificial scarcity that the whole concepts of, oh, who is better qualified, to have access to those resources versus others, all of those are possibilities only when you create this system of scarcity.
So, you know, as we wrap this episode, I'm Priya, I'm just wondering, are there any last thoughts you have, or any last, you know, for the person who is Savarna and just beginning their journey to drop their privilege, any last thoughts or things that you want to share?
I think two things. One is to find a support group where you feel safe. And the second is to read. I'm glad that I started reading Baba Saheb and Phule and other folks at just from a few years ago. And I really wish that I had been exposed much earlier. And I know that I was not exposed to them much earlier because of, you know, this system that keeps you away from such, you know, really useful and intelligent and high quality work that all the anti-caste and other equity fighters have done. Just to start reading, right? Find a support group and start reading. It's never too late. And I think that really informs you in a way that you can translate it to daily practice.
And that you need a community to do daily practice, because this work is very hard and sometimes demoralizing or just heartbreaking. But what I found is that when we approach this work with love and empathy, I always find that compassion opens a much broader platform for us to move the Overton window on what's possible in our communities. And I've definitely felt, Priya, that you really bring that love and that firmness to the way that you organize.
Thank you. But I must say that there are people in my family and friends group who don't think that way. So it's definitely a work in progress.
Well, but I mean, being loving and firm doesn't mean that you're not speaking the truth. And we cannot control the reactions of people to the facts, right? There's just some people who are just deliberately, you know, stuck in their miseducation that don't want to hear past their point of discomfort. But I think that when I say that I see you as a very loving and firm person, is that you are disciplined in like returning the conversation back to what is urgent and what needs to be heard. And that takes a lot of hard work because the miseducation is so strong. And so being that consistent, you know, contrarian voice to the filter bubble that creates caste privilege is hard work, but really the necessary work of allies.
Absolutely.
So just want to thank you again, Priya, for joining us. We've had a lot to kind of chew on here. And, you know, we really wish you well in your work, and also want to thank all of our listeners who joined us in for this conversation. And if you want to learn more and be part of the journey to help stop caste in the diaspora, follow us at Equality Labs at equalitylabs.org. You can also find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And we look forward to seeing you on our next episode. So, Jay Beam.